Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 180, Consciousness and Technology, October 31st, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Computer programs, artificial intelligence, are simulations of intelligence. And in those simulations, the cognition is happening at a symbolic level that's very, very far removed from the physical substrate, the medium of space and time. In the human body, that is not the case. In the human body and the human brain, everything that happens cognitively is directly tied to the physical substrate.
That was my guest, Nova Spivak, explaining why he does not expect that computers will ever attain anything like human consciousness. Nova Spivak is a longtime and seriously committed student of Tibetan Buddhism, an entrepreneur, semantic web pioneer, and technology visionary. He's founded EarthWeb, Radar Networks, and the San Francisco Web Innovators Network. He's also the founder of Lucid Ventures, and he's the grandson of Peter Drucker, the management consultant guru. You can find more details on Nova's fascinating background in our show notes. One warning before we cut to the interview. You've heard of bad hair days? Well, we were having a bad Skype day. Consequently, the audio is not up to our usual standards. There are portions where Nova's speech comes through with a sort of warbly, choppy quality. I tried breaking the interview off at one point and calling him back, but there was no improvement. Still, it's worth putting up with. Everything is still quite intelligible. I felt so lucky to get the interview with Nova in the first place and to find a hole in his super busy schedule for this interview that it's all just too good to pass up. So that being said, let's cut to the interview. Nova Spivak, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, one of my listeners turned me on to your two-part interview on Buddhist Geeks. And right away I said, I've got to get that guy on my show. And so I'm really happy to have you here because the conversation that you had there was fascinating, and I've since been on your blog and found the reference to what you described as your best presentation ever, that I think you were given an award in Stockholm.
Well, it was actually not really an award, but it was an invitation to give a talk to a large media company, the largest media company in Scandinavia, about the global brain.
Yeah, well, I think that was an award in itself then, is getting that invitation.
Yeah, and certainly there was a number of other really wonderful speakers that were invited, and it was kind of like a mini TED conference for Scandinavia.
Yeah, and the TED conference is truly a wonderful thing. I enjoyed a lot of the videos from the TED conference. You know, I think of Nova as the name of the PBS series, as well as a galactic explosion. How did you come by that first name?
Oh, there are many different stories. My mother was a poet, and you know, it's partly poetic license, I think. You know, my parents were artists. It was, you know, in my case, it was 1969, and you know, they were thinking big thoughts. My brother's name is Marin, like Marin County. So you know, we both have these kind of unusual names, and I guess in my mother's case. So one story goes, she was looking up at the stars and had a big inspiration. There are some other stories which are more humorous, but it's hard to tell which one is the real story.
Okay. I just double checking to see if it was a hippie name that you adopted yourself, but I see.
No, it's actually my given name.
Yeah. Okay. So for our listeners, tell us a bit about your background. I understand you were attending university even while enrolled in high school. Maybe you could start there.
Yeah, I grew up in the Boston area. Spent a lot of time around Cambridge. When I was a kid, I was kind of one of the early computer users, I was kind of immersed in the beginning of the PC revolution. There were a number of startups there, and members of my extended family were very involved in that. While I was in high school, I got very interested in computers, and in any case, I ended up convincing University of Massachusetts to let me attend instead of my senior year of high school. So I actually did my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college at the same time. And then after that, I transferred over to Oberlin College. And so I actually ended up doing 5 years of college. One was my senior year of high school, and then I had 4 years of college at Oberlin.
And if I recall correctly, Oberlin's got one of those programs that allows considerable latitude, right, in terms of how you structure your studies?
They do have that option. And actually, I did do that for a while, focusing on cognitive science there. Effectively, I was running my own department, so I had to do all the things that you would do if you ran a department, like getting lots of signatures and petitioning, you know, to do different things and create a curriculum and all of that. That eventually turned out to just be too much work, and so instead the philosophy department agreed to let me take the same courses but to do it under their department, which actually freed me up to not have to deal with a lot of the bureaucracy. But I still got to study the same things. And so I studied neuroscience, computer science, linguistics, intellectual history, artificial intelligence, and philosophy.
Yeah, that begins to get us into some of the juicy areas that we want to talk about. But I also want to touch on the fact that you attended the International Space University and were a space tourist. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, after college, I through various twists and turns, I read a book by an author named Frank White called The Overview Effect, which is about the sort of unexpected spiritual transformations that astronauts went through when they saw the Earth from space. So it's a very interesting book called The Overview Effect, and Frank White is out of Harvard. I wrote him a letter after reading it because I thought it was so interesting, and he actually wrote back and invited me to participate in the formation of a new graduate school that he was involved in called the International Space University, which came out of MIT. So I got involved in that, helped to create their space humanities program, and then was invited to actually attend the program. At that point, it was in Japan, and so I attended the International Space University, which is basically a business school for the space industry. The different space agencies all sponsor it. It's now permanently located in Strasbourg in France, but at the time it was in Japan, and so I did that, and then a number of my friends from that program eventually went on to start a company called Space Adventures, which many of you probably know is the company that takes billionaires up to the space station. So in the early days of Space Adventures in 1999, after the IPO of my first internet company, I had a little spending money, and I was invited over to Russia with the Space Adventures team to sort of test out some of the things they were putting together. And that included flying to the edge of space and also doing zero gravity training in Russia. So that was pretty exciting.
You know, in fact, years ago, I did a magazine interview with Edgar Mitchell, who was one of those astronauts who, looking back at the Earth, had a transformative experience. Did you, in fact, find it to be transformative yourself?
In a way that I didn't expect, yes. I mean, I had spent so much time reading about it and imagining it and also doing, you know, enough spiritual practice and training on my own that, you know, I think some of the sort of big shocking experiences that the astronauts had weren't really that unexpected for me. On the other hand, I did see things which I didn't expect. In fact, instead of the, you know, giant experience of we are one, which I think a lot of astronauts had, which is something I had already had on my own,
yes.
I actually experienced a profound sense of isolation and loneliness up there. You're so far up and so far away from the Earth, and what I really realized was you know, how empty space really is.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty interesting. And also just to see, you know, just really, you know, how far away I was from the Earth and to really see the Earth from that perspective. You know, I'd already had this sort of general sense of you know, Earth being one big living system, but understanding really how isolated it is, I think, was interesting.
Yes. Well, you've also been a very serious student of Tibetan Buddhism for some time. Give us a thumbnail sketch of that, if you can.
I've been studying Tibetan Buddhism formally for about 20 years and Buddhism in general for significantly longer. I started actually reading when I was pretty young and, in high school, got more interested in when I was studying cognitive science in college. I actually ended up doing some pretty focused study of the Buddhist philosophy of mind. I also studied, other philosophies of mind, the Hindu philosophy of mind, for example, which is similar in some respects, mainly because I just couldn't find the answers I was looking for in Western thinking. Most Western philosophy and certainly Western science, in my opinion, is around 2,500 years behind what Eastern thinkers are doing and thinking about when it comes to consciousness and the mind. And so that's kind of what led me there. And then in 1992, I spent a year wandering around in Southeast Asia, living in monasteries in Nepal and India, spending a lot of time with Tibetans.
What is it about Tibetan Buddhism as contrasted to Zen and some of the other variants that particularly speaks to you?
All forms of Buddhism share quite a lot in common. The difference ultimately really comes down to the methods they employ for practice. And in some cases, there are some philosophical subtleties that where you could see distinctions. In the case of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, what appealed to me is first of all, just a broad range of methods and also an extremely developed analytical system, almost scientific explanation and set of texts that really delve into some of the more esoteric and subtle aspects of consciousness, which I was very interested to learn about. I've actually studied in all the traditions. I studied Zen. I've studied in the Vipassana Theravada tradition. I've studied other forms of Buddhism as well. So I've really made a pretty broad survey, but Tibetan Buddhism appealed to me in particular because I was attracted to the practices of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, which are extremely sort of esoteric practices that focus, pretty intensively on the nature of consciousness itself.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Is it possible for you to just kind of give a sort of a capsule description of those two practices?
Well, yeah. I mean, rather than going into each one separately, the essence of the two is really about uncovering what is called the nature of mind. There's mind, which is the conceptual and dualistic process of consciousness that we're all very familiar with. And then there's the nature of mind, which is actually awareness itself. So awareness is not a concept or a conceptual process. I guess a good analogy would be, awareness is kind of like space, and thoughts and concepts are kind of like the things that appear in space. So, we've got planets and stars and galaxies. These appear in space, but they're not exactly the same as space. They're also not exactly different from space in that, they really are nothing but space if you actually analyze them, but they are distinct from space. You can say a planet is a planet. You can see a distinction. And similarly, concepts and the things that take place in the mind, aren't really different from the mind. They're not really different from its nature, but they are distinct in that you can isolate them. You can say, that's a particular thought or, there's a particular process taking place. And so the nature of mind is kind of the space in which the mind is arising. And that is really what Mahamudra and Dzogchen are really focused on. And they have a variety of different techniques to help the practitioner first come to a very clear, direct realization of that nature and all of its various characteristics and implications, and then a whole set of techniques for really developing that further, ultimately to the point where one can actually achieve Buddhahood, which is essentially the full fruition of the inherent qualities of that nature.
I really like that metaphor, the space metaphor. It makes it very clear and understandable. Now, I believe you're currently CEO of yet another company. I think you've morphed through several companies. Is that right?
Yeah, so my first internet company was called EarthWeb, and that was in 1994. I was one of the early internet companies, and we went public actually in 1998. I started another internet company a number of years ago in around 2003. That company is called Radar Networks, and it's what I'm presently running. And our product is a website called Twine.com. Twine, like the string, is a service that ties it all together. And it's using the semantic web. So Twine basically helps you track your interests, discover things around your interests, and organize information around your interests. And it's using the semantic web, which is this new generation of web technology that and essentially makes it possible for applications to do smarter things with content on the web.
Yeah, say just a bit more about semantic web, because it's not a concept that I had run into before hearing you speak. And I thought I was reasonably sophisticated about what was going on the web, but it was a new concept for me.
Well, Tim Berners-Lee, who originated the web, also originated his second act, which what he calls the semantic web. The semantic web goes beyond just HTML, which we probably are all familiar with. HTML is the language that's used to mark up and format content on the web so that web browsers know how to display that content. The semantic web proposes a set of additional markup languages, essentially, these sort of standards for creating metadata, which enables content to be marked up so that software can understand what the content means. So you might imagine, a news article that mentions companies, people, and places. Well, if a software program sees that article, it can't really tell that a certain word is a company and a different word is a person and another word is a place. It doesn't know because it can't really read and understand the language. However, with a semantic web, you can put little tags around things that say, this is a company or this is a particular company and there's more information over here about it. This is a particular person. This is a reference to a product. This is a reference to an event. So it allows you to mark up content with little tags, essentially, that add meaning to that content. And this is meaning that machines can understand. So rather than having to create artificial intelligence that can read and understand documents, you simply need applications which can read and understand these tags. And the tags are much simpler. They can be standardized, or at least the meaning of the tags can actually be defined in a way that machines can understand. And so it's a sort of attempt to add more structure to the web so that machines can make better sense of it.
Interesting. You say instead of using artificial intelligence, so it's as if we are implanting a bit more of our intelligence into each of those pages, if you will.
Exactly. In fact, that's how I often describe it, is we're sort of moving the intelligence out of applications and into the data. We could think of it as smart data. The data starts to carry more of what's needed to make sense of the data. And that means that applications don't have to be as powerful. They can be essentially thinner. As long as they can speak this kind of meta language, they can then pull in what's needed to understand different sets of data that they might encounter. And so this is kind of the beginning of what I think of as the externalization of human knowledge. We started with the web, just putting content out there, then things like the Wikipedia, building giant collections, but those collections aren't really understandable to software. So this next step is to actually make all of that understandable to software so that human knowledge can start to be processed by machines.
One of the things I liked about the talk that you gave in Stockholm was the progression that you took your audience through of Web 1 through Web 4.0. Maybe you could just kind of step us through that. It was a nice vision of the kind of the sweep from the past to the future.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So basically, I see the web proceeding in decades. We can talk about them as Web 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, and 4.0, and these are the four decades of the web. We're currently in Web 2.0, the second decade. So 1.0 was 1990 to 2000, the first decade of the web, and now we're in the 2000 to 2010 decade. So each of these decades has a different kind of character or main theme. The first decade of the web was really focused on the back-end core technologies of the web. The second decade that we're in now, Web 2.0, has really been focused on the user experience, or what we might call the front-end of the web. It's really about making it usable and making it more social. As we move into the coming third decade, 2010 to 2020, the emphasis shifts back to the back end or the core technologies of the web, and there we're upgrading the structure, the content, the software of the web to be smarter. And then when we go to the fourth decade, Web 4.0 in 2020, the focus will shift back again to the front end. So there's a pendulum that's kind of swinging back and forth every decade. It will shift back to the front end, and there the focus will be on making smarter applications that make use of this more structured content on the web. And, of course, in that period of time, I don't expect that people will be sitting at computers anymore. I think, for the most part, it will be in a much more mobile kind of world where, you know, we'll always be online, and it will be through some kind of mobile device or devices embedded in our physical environments. So wherever we are, the Internet will always be there. The key will be to make it smart, because we won't always have a keyboard, and we won't always have the time or patience to be scrolling through lots of pages. We'll want the web to really be able to anticipate or understand exactly what we want and just give us, you know, one or two things that really, really relate to what we really want in the context we're in.
You see the web emerging as a kind of global mind. How so?
Well, you know, the concept of a global mind actually started with this notion of a global brain, which has actually been a big idea that's been developing for at least 100 years, if not more. You can trace it back to people like H.G. Wells, in fact, or even earlier thinkers who have called for this. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a French philosopher, also wrote a lot about the Omega Point, which he believed we were heading towards. And there have been really many other writers in the past and great thinkers who've kind of originated this idea. Most recently, you know, with the Internet, we've seen a kind of resurgence in thinking around this, and there have been people like Peter Russell, Gregory Stock, Kevin Kelly, and others who have been writing about the global brain and how the Internet seems to be heading in this direction. My own thinking, I tend to make a certain distinction. You know, I don't think that the Internet on its own is a global brain. I don't think that artificial intelligence or software, no matter how much of it we have, will constitute a global brain, because there's one essential element that is required, and that is consciousness. And where does the consciousness come from? Not from machines. It comes from people. We are the consciousness of the system. So I think we are creating a kind of global brain and a global mind, but we have to include people in that picture. So the sum total of all the people on the web, and then all the content and all the software and hardware and infrastructure, when you take all of that together as one big system, it is actually quite brain-like. It's actually an organism, or what we might call a superorganism, like an ant colony. It's an organism that's made of organisms. It's definitely thinking. It's learning. It's evolving. It's getting smarter. And in a couple of decades, it'll probably start to become more self-aware. Now, the self-awareness is the big question. You know, in what form will it be self-aware? Will there be one sort of mental fusion, single identity out there that says, I am the web, I'm aware of myself? Highly unlikely. I think instead what we'll have is kind of high-level representations of collective identity and collective self. These will be kind of like sites that reflect back what's going on or what masses of people are doing and thinking. And then the feeling or sense of I am this, or the awareness, or what might be called the knowing or qualia in a philosophical, technical sense of this experience of the web, that will actually reside in the minds of the people who are watching. So the, if you will, the self-construct of the web will be sort of existing on various websites that serve as sort of high-level representations of what's going on, but the self-awareness or the knowing of that construct will reside in the minds of the people who make up the web. And so, in a sense, there will be a kind of collective intelligence, a collective self, and a collective awareness taking place. You won't be able to find one particular point that is the self or the awareness of the system. And in fact, if you look at our own brains and minds, you can't find a single point anywhere there that is the self or awareness either. So it's quite analogous. If we admit or believe that the human brain, which is this vastly complex system, is able to have a sense of self and some form of awareness, even though, you know, it's comprising, you know, billions of separate parts, then why can't the same thing happen for the web, which also comprises billions of parts?
I'm starting to have a fantasy of this giant superorganism meditating and asking itself, you know, who am I? Where is myself?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. you know, it could happen, although I think it's the larger the system and the higher you get on the scale of superorganisms, the less likely it is that you'll have a single coherent thought. You know, it's possible that there might be moments where a large majority of the people and machines on the web focus on one thing. And, you know, there's actually a project that's quite interesting. It's called the Global Consciousness Project out of Princeton. And they have random number generators that are scattered around the web. These are machines that are isolated from electrical interference and so forth. And what they found, it's very strange, but at certain periods in time, and nobody can explain why, all of these random number generators become highly correlated. And it's brief, but there's no explanation for it. You know, they should always be random. It should always be kind of noisy. But in fact, there are moments when they all seem to get kind of synchronized, and it doesn't make sense. There's no statistical explanation. It violates all our understandings of statistics. Even more strange is that at these moments, we also, if we look, they tend to correspond, or at least often have corresponded, with major global events, such as, 9/11, or earthquakes and wars and other catastrophes. So, strangely enough, it seems like these random number generators kind of go into a form of coherence at the same time as large numbers of people seem to be also in coherence. So nobody knows why, but one speculation is that there's some kind of a field that is at play here, and consciousness is somehow affecting that field, or maybe it is that field. And when you get enough people, or enough consciousnesses, if you will, kind of focused in together on one thing, the nature of that field changes enough to actually change the randomness of the universe or the local region of the universe that we're in. And so random number generators would then behave differently. It's a very strange project. It's quite scientific, but it has a lot of implications. Anybody can look this up and look at their data and see for yourself. Nobody knows what's going on, and they also don't know what's going on. All they can say is there's something strange happening. Well, you know, that's evidence for the possibility of collective consciousness or collective consciousness having some kind of an effect on the physical world. As far as collective consciousness getting to a level of sophistication where it could actually think a thought and everybody in it could actually feel and experience that thought, that I won't say it's impossible, but I think it's a long way off. I think we'll probably start with much more primitive things first, such as simply creating some sort of shared mirror of what the global mind is thinking. And that's a project I'm very interested in, to kind of create a site which tries to figure out and represent back kind of what the global mind is thinking about.
In a sense, it seems to me that maybe Twitter does that a bit. What do you think about that?
Well, not exactly. I mean, services like Twitter don't really do any interpretation. They just, you can look at the stuff that's streaming through. It's just like looking at, there are services which sometimes show, for example, a stream of queries in a search engine. You can see what people are searching for. But a global mind or global self needs to actually be a higher level construct that derives an interpretation from this vast flow. One example is Google Zeitgeist, which you can dig around for and find on Google. And it basically shows what are the most popular queries on Google right now. That gives you a sense of what are some of the sort of big interests. But that's still a very primitive and not very high-resolution picture. It's useful, though. What I'm thinking about is that, but take it much further. You know, not only see what people are kind of searching for, what they're thinking about, but look at trends, look at sentiment about certain issues, look at differences in different places or different demographic groups. Be able to slice and dice the data to really understand, is there a difference between what people in the U.S. are thinking and maybe what people in China are thinking, and how does it differ? Also, how are thoughts moving, if you will? I wrote a paper once called A Physics of Ideas, which proposed a way to analyze the media in order to basically figure out how ideas are moving through the world, that is, geographically and demographically, to trace how a particular idea is spreading from one population to another, for example. So I think there's a lot of things we can actually do using technology to start to figure out what's going on in this vast collective brain, which we call the web, And by doing that, we can actually start to represent it back and create something that becomes the seed of a kind of global mind.
You may have just invented a new field, maybe called memology.
Well, there is memetics. Maybe memology is a really interesting term. I do think that memes, which are, ideas that replicate and move around kind of like viruses, memes are very important, possibly the most important things that are shaping our world, and our understanding or even recognition of them is incredibly primitive today. Some people have even proposed, just as we would see really the human body as just a life support system for genes, for spreading genes,
yes,
it may also really be just a life support system for spreading memes.
That we may be the life, we're the hosts for spreading memes?
Yeah, and maybe what's really going on is that ideas are evolving, and the human genome and the human body really are there just to help ideas evolve. That's a very kind of meta level way of looking at what's going on. Of course, ideas themselves, aren't really physical things. They have sort of physical representations in various places. But they definitely seem to be shaping our world. I mean, if you look at intellectual history, you could look at it as a battle of ideas.
As I hear you talk about this, I have the feeling that somehow Buddhism crosscuts some of what you've been talking about. I mean, isn't there even, for example, the Hindu idea that all of this is illusion and Maya, that maybe we're not even real in the way that we, think we're real?
Sure. I studied with some Hindu teachers as well in the past. Buddhism is historically really a reaction to Hinduism. And so they have actually quite a lot in common. The basic difference is that Buddhism goes one step further than the sort of Hindu philosophy, where the Hindu philosophy focuses on ultimately achieving this sort of oneness with the cosmic self, which they might call the Atman. Buddhism refutes the notion of a single cosmic self, and instead what you achieve oneness with is the cosmic absence of self. And so there's a very important subtle distinction there. However, many have misunderstood the Buddhist notion of emptiness or the absence of self as a form of nihilism. It's not a form of nihilism. In fact, there still is a kind of cosmic being, but it's not a self. And so Buddhism sort of says, the Hindus almost got it right. There is this kind of cosmic oneness, but it's not a truly existing entity of that could be personified or even thought of as one sort of single entity. Instead, it's much more like a vast infinite space from which everything springs. And that space has a quality of being aware, or at least of being the source of awareness. But awareness itself is just like space and also is kind of empty. So these are the kind of highest views in Buddhist philosophy. And very hard to put into words because they're somewhat paradoxical, which is why Zen doesn't even attempt to put them into words. Instead, it just deals directly with paradoxes to help you break free of grasping at dualistic explanations of reality.
Okay. Now, to step back just a little bit, you've been influenced by the ideas of Ray Kurzweil, with whom you've also worked. And he talks about a concept that he calls the singularity, which I have taken to understand as the internet, if you will, actually becoming conscious. It sounds like you don't go quite as far with that as he does.
Well, to be specific, the concept of a singularity was not originated by Ray Kurzweil, although he's been the one who's popularized it. The first person to really talk about it was a science fiction writer named Werner Vinge. And he talked about a technological singularity, which was going to occur when we created software or hardware or both that was so intelligent it exceeded our ability to imagine what it could do. So basically, it would be a point in time when computers became so much smarter than people that we couldn't really predict what would happen after that. In other words, they'd be ultra-intelligent. They'd be the last things we'd ever invent, because from then on, they'd be making all the inventions. Ray Kurzweil's concept of the singularity sort of modernized this a bit. He's been charting the course of technological progress, particularly around information technology, over the last 20 or 30 years. And what he's found is that there are these exponential growth curves, which are that just occur no matter pretty much no matter what happens, whether we have a Great Depression or not, whether we have a war, whether we have a recession, no matter what happens, everything seems to keep continuing to progress on these exponential curves. In particular, for example, one famous one is what's called Moore's Law, which talks about the density of semiconductors and the fact that the cost to put them onto chips is decreasing, as well as the density which we can put them onto chips is increasing. So basically, there are a number of these different laws out there, or we could say patterns that we see, which indicate the pace of technological progress, at least around information technology, is rapidly advancing on this exponential curve. If that continues, and it looks like it will, then by about 2030 or 2040, the computation necessary to simulate or do is the same amount of computation that we currently think a human brain does will cost about $1. So, you know, it will mean that you could very easily have a brain simulation, or at least if our present understanding of what that entails is correct, you know, and that could fit on a mobile device like your phone. Beyond that, before the end of this century, it should be possible to simulate or actually to exceed the computing capacity of all human brains with perhaps a small amount of money. And what small means is relative, but, you know, it could be anywhere from a few $1,000s to a few $1,000,000s, but, you know, it won't cost that much. So if that's the case, then, you know, in this century, computer intelligence or at least computation that's artificial will exceed natural computation in the form of human beings. And when that happens, the next question is, well, will it actually be smarter? Just because you can do more computations doesn't mean that you make something that's smarter. Because intelligence isn't merely just brute force computation. It's really a very highly refined form of computation. There's a particular, you know, structure that's taking place. So I'm pretty skeptical, actually, that just because we'll have brute force computation, that entails that we would somehow have artificial intelligence. I think artificial intelligence is extremely subtle and it doesn't rely purely on brute force computation. People who believe in the singularity in a strong sense would say, well, what we'll do is we'll map the brain, we'll basically scan it into a computer, we'll map it down to the neuron or even subneuronal level, and we'll just literally copy it, and we'll just run a simulation of the brain in a computer, and we won't even have to understand what it does. It'll just be intelligent because we'll be copying it. Where this all breaks down is, first of all, at what resolution does the brain really compute? Currently, we think it's happening on a neuronal level, but there's evidence now coming out that it's happening at a much deeper level, on the quantum level, in fact, within the neurons. If that's true, then the resolution of the brain's computer, if you will, the granularity, may be 12 times deeper than what we currently think. And so it might be significantly longer before we can really copy it or simulate it, no matter how many computers we can bring to bear in this century. We might not get there even in this century, depending on how much computation is really happening. But there's even more to the story. And that gets to kind of something I've been writing about lately, which is that we don't yet know how important the medium is to intelligence and consciousness. That is, you know, the only intelligence and consciousness we currently know of happens in living organic things like people, animals, and insects. We have not seen any evidence of it in any other form. Now, those sort of in the strong AI and computer science camps, and certainly the hardcore singularity people would say, well, there's nothing particularly about, you know, one form of matter that's special. Why should, you know, organic molecules have some special privilege of being consciousness? And, you know, and also, by the way, computers are made of plastic, they're organic too. So why not? Well, what I would say is this. Computer programs, artificial intelligence, are simulations of intelligence. And in those simulations, the cognition is happening at a symbolic level that's very, very far removed from the physical substrate, the medium of space and time. In the human body, that is not the case. In the human body and the human brain, everything that happens cognitively is directly tied to the physical substrate. That is, When a neuron fires, or when chemicals interact within a synapse, that is actually caused and also conditions on the quantum level. So in other words, there are quantum things taking place in space and time that are percolating up, and also there are effects that are percolating down that are affecting the quantum structure of space and time, and that's all happening in our bodies.
A lot of what you're talking about then is a kind of very rich sensory stew. Is that right?
It's not just a rich sensory stew, though. It's that we are literally space and time, and our thoughts and our cognition are very, very tightly connected to the structure of space and time. In a simulation, in a computer simulation, for example, what's happening, the cognition in that simulation is actually shielded from space and time. In other words, what's going on a quantum level in the vicinity that computer is in may have no bearing at all on what takes place at this very, very high level in its simulated cognition. But that's not the case in the human body. In the human body, we're literally processing the quantum structure of space and time. We are physical machines, and our thoughts actually connect to the physical reality that we're embedded in. So, a computer simulation, it's many levels removed from the physical nature of the universe. In other words, in a computer, when it makes a construct, for example, let's say within a computer program, you make a cube that appears floating in space. Whatever happens, in physical space where that computer is, doesn't really affect that cube in any way. That cube is a kind of high-level construct that exists many levels removed from physical reality, and all of the structure and the circuitry in a computer is really designed to actually shield the computer from effects, from electromagnetic effects, really control what's going on. But in the human brain, that's not the case. If you imagine a cube in your mind, that cube is somehow actually taking place in space and time. It's imaginary, but it's connected to your brain, which itself is highly sensitive to what's going on the quantum level. And in fact, what appears in your mind may in fact filter back down and actually have effects on the quantum level of reality itself. So there may actually be much more interaction between what we're doing in our minds and our brains and actual physical reality itself. And that's quite different than the setup of an artificial intelligence simulation of a mind. It's very hard to explain this, but in fact, there is a very, very different setup. It's a night and day situation. So if we are going to create artificial intelligence, it probably, in my opinion, will need to be embedded in a system that's much more like a human body, that's much more connected to the actual substrate of space and time. And I don't think that currently that's the direction that AI researchers are going in. In any case, if that turns out to be important, if the substrate, that is physical reality, is quite important to true consciousness and intelligence, then it might be a long time or maybe never before we are able to actually make, quote, artificial intelligence. I'm skeptical about that. I think that, artificial intelligence isn't even really that necessary, at least in the way that some people think about it. We don't need to replace people. We already have them. We don't even need to simulate them. It's very useful, I think, to make intelligent machines that can assist humans, but I'm very, very skeptical that we'll be able to synthesize consciousness. We don't even know what consciousness is. And, to synthesize it is hubris. We're so far behind even Eastern thinkers on the subject of consciousness. It took them thousands of years to evolve a highly refined understanding of consciousness. We haven't even started. So, we might make brains, we might make sophisticated machines, but I don't think they'll be very, very smart. I think they'll be basically glorified video cameras.
It's really interesting to hear you think about these things, because I think you're in a unique position coming at the study of consciousness both as a Buddhist and as a technologist. And so that's a very unique and fascinating blend.
It's important. I want to point out one thing also to anybody who's listening who might be picking up on this. I am not proposing some form of dualism. It's very important to make that clear. I'm not proposing that consciousness is some special magic substance. I'm not proposing that is a mysterious ghost that, you know, appears. I'm saying that it may be fundamental, just like space and time are fundamental. So this is the key point. Space, time, and even energy are fundamental properties of the universe, and no physicist would claim to know what they are. In fact, you can't even measure them directly. Nobody actually measures them directly. Nobody can grasp space. Nobody can grasp time. Nobody can grasp energy. All of our measurements of these things are actually inferences that we make by looking at things that we can measure. For example, how do we know that there's really time? Well, we measure the change in various things that we can see. We never see time, right? Similarly, how do we know that there's space? Well, nobody can see space. But we do see that there are objects that get larger and smaller, or that things tend to move, and that, for example, light bends when it goes past a star. There are various things that happen that enable us to infer that there's something that we call space and it has some kind of shape, and, you know, and that it exists. But we never actually see it. Well, the same is true of consciousness. And in fact, I tend to think space, time, and consciousness, and even energy, are really all one thing. And, you know, this is the future grand unification which we'll someday reach. You know, currently we've unified a few of these, you know, thanks to Einstein, right? Matter and energy. And to some degree, space, time, matter, and energy have been unified. But, you know, consciousness, that other aspect, is still not in the equation. And that's a big weakness in our civilization. It's something which, by the way, ancient civilizations were farther along on. They didn't get as far on the matter, energy part of the equation, but they made more progress on the consciousness part. We don't even see the equation yet. But in any case, you know, we've spent our points on the physical, external, materialist side. Other civilizations, the ancient Peruvians, the Native Americans, ancient Africans, ancient Indian civilizations, you know, Chinese and Buddhist civilizations, these ancient civilizations were actually quite far along on the other part of the equation, the consciousness dimension.
Wow. I think that's probably a good place for us to wrap this up. And I know that you are extremely busy with all of your undertakings, so I really want to thank you for taking time out to be my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks. It was my pleasure. I hope this made sense and that people can get some interesting new directions for thinking from this.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Nova Spivak and that you didn't find the audio too taxing. I have to say, he did give me some new directions for my own thinking. I was particularly fascinated by his notion toward the end of our conversation that consciousness may be another primary dimension of the universe, along with space, time, and energy. I think I've heard this idea before, but I've never heard it stated in quite these terms, and maybe it's just starting to sink in with me finally. Synchronistically, later in the same day, I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, the Australian series All in the Mind with Natasha Mitchell, and they were examining the question of just how far down the phylogenetic scale cognition and possibly therefore consciousness goes. I was surprised to learn that there are leading microbiologists who feel like it goes sort of all the way down. Quoting from Natasha Mitchell in her episode on the secret life of bacteria, small, smart, and thoughtful, she says, quotes, "It turns out you are possibly only 1% human and 99% microbial if you were to do a cell count. En masse, these single-cell critters manage to do staggering things without a head or a heart. They cooperate with each other, coalesce in vast, intricate patterns, biofilms, and swarms, sense and respond to the world around them, hunt and kill in coordinated packs. They even possess a form of memory. But does all this mean bacterial colonies are cognitive, even conscious? And might their behavior reveal something about our own? Far-fetched suggestions for some, not so for others." And then she goes on to interviewing some leading microbiologists who are devoting their careers to studying mentation in microbes, with some arguing that they appear to have all the qualities that we would associate with consciousness. To me, this would add weight to Nova Spivak's assertion that consciousness may indeed be one of the basic building blocks of the universe. Certainly, this has long been the position of many metaphysical schools of thought. Sounds like science might be moving in that direction as well. Exciting stuff.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
I'm hoping that you noticed there was no recorded advertisement at the beginning of this episode, and I'm not going to push any sponsors now. Rather than touting products that you may or may not be interested in, I'd rather enlist your support by promoting a product I really believe in, which is Shrink Wrap Radio. So to this end, I've created a donate tab at shrinkwrapradio.com with several levels of voluntary donation. As you may know, I've flirted with the idea of what has come to be called the premium content model, in which part or all of Shrink Wrap Radio would be available only to paid subscribers. Somehow I can't quite bring myself to go that direction. It just doesn't feel in keeping with what I'm about. So instead, I'm keeping all of the content free and accessible. That's currently 180 shows, each of which has cost me 10 or more hours to produce. I'm in my fourth year of producing this series, and I'd like to keep going. And your financial support will inspire me not to let up. I'd like to drop all other advertising other than an appeal to you for your support. My intention is to try this approach for a few months. If the support from you is forthcoming, then I'll keep it ad-free. So many of you have written to say how much you love the show and how much you learn from the interviews. I'm hoping you'll show some love now by making a donation to support this effort. The donate links on the site will take you to a secure page where you can use either PayPal or a credit card to make either single or recurring donations.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Hey, son Matthew, thanks for that transition. Now let's check out some of your email from the listener community. Now you're going to think that I made this first one up, but I swear it's genuine. It's from Gary, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, I just responded to your donation survey." You know, I had a survey on the website asking about whether people would support me in this new direction. And so Gary wrote, "I just responded to your donation survey. Free content and donations are definitely the way to go. I listen to a lot of podcasts, but donate to few. I don't mind giving financial support to those who provide value, podcasts or any other media for that matter, and I find yours to be exceptional. I started listening to you back when your podcast episode numbers were in the single digits." All right. "I sent you an email back then. You were practically begging for email, and I didn't want you to give up, so I told you how your podcast was helping me. I've not missed one since. Yeah, I suffered through those early sound issues you had, but the content was always worth it. If you get the donations thing going, I'd be willing to set up a monthly recurring charge to my credit card. The subscription model seems to do well, and it's pretty painless. Thanks for all you do, Gary." Gary, thank you so much for that vote of support, and is definitely enough to kind of kick me over the edge and get me started. So I know I've got one donor out there. Thank you so much. And thanks for sticking with the show for so long and suffering through those sound problems, which now, unfortunately, have revisited us a little bit. Rick V. wrote to comment on show number 177, the one where I recently spoke to a psychology class or with a psychology class at Sonoma State University about the psychological impact of social networking technologies. Rick writes, "Hey Dave, I know you were concerned about how the technology show went. You seemed especially worried about your own performance was off and to covet some feedback. I listened to the entire show. I can't say that about every show you've aired. There are shows I believe I stopped listening to because the topic or guest was not engaging my interest. In none of these shows were you the reason for my loss of interest. With that in mind, allow me to comment on the evolution of your skills as a broadcaster. It is because of you that some topics that I would otherwise pass on, I have instead elected to listen to. You have developed a very valuable skill, the ability to make topics that typically interest a narrow audience draw the attention of a wider audience. With that said, the technology show was a little dull, and it seemed to me that you were a little bored by the conversation and topic, but you still managed to hold my interest, and I bet the same could be said of other listeners. I think it's your own feeling about how undynamically the topic unfolded that caused you to have doubts about your personal performance. Again, you were fine. The topic was, at least for me, not that exciting. You, sir, are growing in this area, and believe me, I have no problem telling people, when they ask, that they weren't so hot on a particular day. Your show has a fireside chat quality to it. If I detected anything, it was that you perhaps wanted to throw this show into the inferno. Even Hemingway wrote stuff he didn't feel very good about. This is the cross that all creative people must bear. Sincerely, Rick V., the Insomniac. And he says, P.S., have you ever thought about trying to get John Nash, the It's a Beautiful Mind guy, on your show as a guest? I think he would be a fascinating interview. You know, I thought that he wasn't alive anymore, I have to confess. I'll have to look into that, Rick. And thanks for your reassurance, Rick, and your straight feedback about that show. I did wrestle with whether or not to throw it into the inferno or not. The next email says, hi there. Unfortunately, I just found out about your podcasts, and I was wondering how I can download to iTunes the episodes number 1 to 100, since they're not listed on the iTunes store when I subscribed. I would appreciate your help. Thanks for the good programs. I especially liked the number 175 about the Toltecs. Great surprise for me to find out about them. Best regards, Marcio Melo. Actually, Marcio, I wonder if you're in Mexico. But at any rate, actually, there are two ways, you know, in case other people are joining the series late and you're wondering how to get the back shows, there are two ways to do it. One is all of the shows are archived at shrinkwrapradio.com. So if you go to the show, to the website directly, you can listen to any of the 180 episodes right on your computer, right then and there, or you have the option of downloading them onto your hard drive so that you can then transfer it to an MP3 player. Alternatively, all of the past episodes are on iTunes, but they're not all in the same place. If you go into iTunes, you'll see there are actually 4 mentions of Shrink Wrap Radio, or 4 icons. I don't know how to describe it. And one of those is the current series. And the other 3 are for the years, they're organized by year. So there's one for 2007, 2006, and a grouping for 2005. So I hope that helps all you newcomers. Keep coming, tell your friends, spread the word. I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. I still beg for them. And remember that you can also leave voice comments that I don't get nearly enough of. You can leave those on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave them on our phone, which is 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Nova Spivak for a very engaging interview. And next week's guest will be Stanford brain researcher Dr. Philippe Golden, who's been comparing the effects of mindfulness meditation and cognitive behavioral therapy on the brain. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.